It is Tuesday, the 12th of November. For those of you keeping track at home, it's 11, 12, 13.
I love that.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
I think it's neat. I didn't really realize that until about
And it's,
eight
in fact,
ago.
9, 10, 11, 12, 13 as we speak right now.
So
wow.
Awesome. 9, 10, wow, 11,
what a
12,
moment.
13. Remember this moment. Remember where you were when you heard it. And stay with it forever. Okay. Welcome to our panel. We have WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is with us. And also joining us, University at Albany Journalism Professor and Investigative Reporter Rosemary Armeo. Good morning, all. How are you?
Good. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, it's always a delight to have you with us. So let us jump right in and talk about what is happening today. We have some very interesting topics, and we even have a request. So we'll get to that. Rosemary made a topic request. It's very exciting. Let's talk about the huge story, of course, which is continuing to dominate world headlines and just becomes more troubling and devastating as the news comes out, and that is the typhoon that hit the Philippines. The scale of the devastation and the desperation wrought by one of the most powerful storms ever came into much clearer view on Monday, 3 days after it hopscotched across the country's midsection, whipping up monstrous whales of seawater. Survivors spoke of people being swept away in tsunami-like torrents, their corpses strewn among the wreckage of the storm. And again, an official death toll in the thousands, but expected to be tens of thousands. By some estimates, at least 10,000 people may have died in this one area alone. And unfortunately, it will be a long time before we probably have a clear picture of exactly the human toll that the storm has taken. Now we start talking about relief efforts, and we just heard from the BBC that an airport has opened and a main road has opened, which aids
in getting
the relief in and starting. And obviously we were saying yesterday about how this becomes all too common. By the same token, there's no plan for this kind of devastation. I mean, you really do have to start, find out what's there, what isn't there, and then figure out. And I think it's sort of like doing it one grain of sand at a time, mm-hmm. I guess.
Yeah, the U.S. is taking a leadership role and moving an aircraft carrier toward there. It's not supposed to be there for a couple of days. But that will provide helicopters and means to get some of these isolated areas some aid. But it just sounds like it sounds a lot like the tsunami.
In Japan,
2004 Christmas Day, 2004.
That's right. Yeah, 2004 Christmas Day, the tsunami that Indonesia. And I mean, it's hard to fathom the devastation. I mean, it just sounds awful. And what did the report say today? There's another report for a tropical storm coming their way, and
This is an area that gets more of these kinds of natural calamities than nearly any other place on Earth. That's interesting too. I like the coverage that's taking a look at why the devastation was so complete, and it isn't just global warming. It isn't just that there's horrendous natural disasters. It's that this is a really vulnerable area, very poor grade of construction. These are flimsy houses that are going to go down. And it's interesting to think of a storm like that hit, say, in the United States, where presumably construction is of higher quality. Would there have been the death tolls we're seeing?
Well, from my understanding is that it was 7-point-something. They had an earthquake recently that sort of rattled a lot of the already poor infrastructure.
Exactly.
And then the storm comes in on top of that, mm-hmm. and causes a great deal of destruction. And as I said earlier on, there's also this hopscotch nature of the storm where it would go to different areas of the country.
Yeah. But,
as you said, Micah, the U.S. taking a leadership role, and I think we're just now starting. I said this yesterday that I hadn't seen any of the here's where you can help things that you always
they're
do.
Beginning
you're
to
you're
roll
starting
out.
To see
yeah,
those
yeah,
now.
Yeah, they're beginning to roll out. And what they need more than anything is cash. I mean, quickly, you know.
Slate had an excellent – I'm sorry.
Yeah,
not, I don't mean to drop it. Slate had an interesting story about this, saying the generosity of Americans has to be reined in. Do not send teddy bears. Do not send, old drugs. Do not send breast milk. These are not things that people need in the Philippines right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, the quickest, fastest way to help is donating, like, to the Red Cross.
Right.
You know,
no teddy bears, no breast right. milk. Let me just read that.
Yeah.
Well, I think people
it's true. They kind of empty out their closets and help.
You know, and in the U.S., if there was something in a, you know, nearby state, the Air Guard would, you know, airlift down clothing and supplies to areas that might be hit by a hurricane along the southern coast or something. But even that's difficult to measure whether that's even practical. But right now they need clean water, they need medical supplies, and they need help, just getting shelter, you know.
Yeah.
And the fastest way is
tents and
money.
Blankets.
And, you know, with the USS George Washington on its way there, they say 5,000 sailors are on that ship, and they'll be at the ports to help deploy whatever goods come in from international agencies. But it seems like it's just taking a long time, and the need is so immediate from every report. It's pretty devastating.
There's a story about a young woman who gave birth to a child at a kind of makeshift clinic in the middle of all of this. I cannot imagine being a mother with young children, no house, no food, no order of any sort, trying to make it through. Pouring rain. To us, it's just a few days, like less than a week. But to her, it must be hell.
Well, the value of these riveting stories is to, you know, maybe help people to focus on the need to step up like they did during the tsunami. Remember all the efforts by Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush to go around for months after that and go around the world and try to raise awareness of it. And this is one of the things that happens with disasters. There's disaster fatigue, and people, that's really awful, and then they clip, onto the next thing. So
I already
really,
gave to the earthquake. Yeah. I don't have anything for the tsunami.
Right. And it is really important to recognize that this is an immediate and harsh need. And, of course, there's many, we've had stories, and other media in the capital region have had stories. There's a large Filipino-American community, and many people are trying to get in touch with their families and have been, not able to because of the
virtually impossible.
So it's a very stressful time for anybody who's got family in the Philippines, not knowing their whereabouts and how they're doing, and that may help us by telling those stories, and the local connections may help us understand that these people are in the Philippines are in desperate need, and we should step up.
There's also an issue of human behavior. There have been stories from some of the relief agencies that they can't get in because they get mobbed, and anything that they have literally is ripped away from them.
And there's looting always, and there's people who are desperate, people who have been without food and water, people who are trying their best to do anything they can to survive. And it's a real challenge for these relief organizations that have experience dealing with this, and I guess it's good that they do.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I think of would I behave that way?
I would.
In other words, if your family
yes.
had nothing, no water, no milk, no food, nothing, would you break the law in order to survive?
Oh, well, I don't think it's – morally, I don't think it's breaking the law if your family is starving and there's a store there that's been, closed, and you go in and help yourself. I mean, that's
survival.
Kind of thing that happens. I mean, I suppose there will be people that will exploit this, and there's always that, unfortunately. But people facing this kind of a grim situation, I don't know what laws apply. If you have a starving family in need of food or medical supplies and you have some way to get it, it's...
But if you happen to be the store owner, and I don't want to be unsympathetic to what you're saying,
right.
And it's not a matter of carrying milk out, but you see people carrying televisions out.
That's
a different story.
We had this with Katrina as well, too, and it's the whole politics of aid is really interesting. For example, we sent food over. You keep sending food over, as we did say, to Haiti, and you're putting everyone in that country who sells food, you're putting them out of business because you can't compete with free.
Right.
So the aid has to be rethought. There's a way to help people to get them past the immediate problem, this horrible situation they're in now, but to get businesses up and running again so that they can supply needs. So easy for us to talk because we're not in
absolutely.
There. Because I'd be there clawing, screaming,
well,
and getting a bag of rice.
No, that's the point. Can you project yourself into, you know, what you would do if it was your kids and your family that needed to survive?
One of the other things that this is more of a question about the coverage of it, and because I've really found the stories to be, I mean, it's such devastation and it's so heartbreaking. And to hear – last night I was watching a report, I believe it was on the NewsHour, where there is just, you know, the wailing and the crying. And then 10, 20 bodies washing up on the shore because so many people were taken out to the ocean, and now those bodies are coming back on shore. This is really tough stuff to watch.
It's
misery. And it's tough. And I understand what you were saying about the human interest story and giving people – you know, a glimpse into this so that it can elicit some help and aid. But boy, it's tough stuff to watch.
This is a big problem for foreign correspondents who cover this sort of thing, and war correspondents have it too. When you're there, of course, you're wrapped up in it.
Sure.
But it's so difficult to convey the whole sensual experience, the sound of it, the smell of rotting bodies. You know, you can mention that in a story, but smelling it is a whole different thing. The light, the absolute absence, the panoramic absence, which, you know, you've all taken tourist pictures. You can't really capture the Grand Canyon in photos. You cannot really capture with a camera the kind of devastation, wide-scale devastation that goes on in these events. And that's so frustrating for the correspondents who can't get the reaction they want, that they themselves are having because they're right there.
Yes, I mean, the role of the media during a major disaster like this, I think the most important thing is to continue to tell the story in a compelling way, and it's difficult because people begin to turn it off because of what you just said, Joe.
Right.
I mean,
it
becomes
so
painful to watch and to read about, and you can, you know, and yet somehow you've got to tell the story in a way that is compelling, and tell the story of the woman that had the baby, or tell the story of the local family in Albany, New York, that's trying to reach their, you know, their relatives in Tacloban, the Philippines, and bring it home so that we can at least, you know, step up and react with compassion and dollars.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation and then go to NPR News. We welcome your comments, as always. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org.
Support for WAMC comes from Saratoga and North Creek Railway, announcing the Polar Express, a round-trip train ride from Saratoga to the North Pole, with Santa, elves, caroling, hot cocoa, and more, November 15th through December 29th, SaratogaPolarExpressRide.com. Deerfield Cabinets, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, providing all wood cabinets, granite countertops, and other built-to-order options for kitchen, bathroom, and throughout the home. DeerfieldCabinets.com. And Mid-Hudson Valley Federal Credit Union, celebrating 50 years, serving the financial needs of members in Ulster, Orange, and Dutchess counties. MHVFCU.com/50 years.
Welcome back to here's the church, here's the steeple, open the door, see all the people, except for one. Welcome back to our discussion. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. We just have a few minutes before we go over to NPR News and get the latest of what is happening throughout the world, but want to talk about Secretary of State John Kerry and the nuclear deal that they're working on with Iran. Secretary of State John Kerry came up a few disputed words short of closing a landmark deal with Iran on Sunday in Geneva. Now he is defending the diplomacy that led to that near miss against a rising chorus of critics at home and abroad. On Monday, they are in the United Arab Emirates. They are deeply suspicious of a nuclear Iran. Mr. Kerry laid out his fullest argument yet and promised America's allies in the Middle East that a nuclear accord would not put their security at risk. So what do you make of this, of the situation and the criticism that the Secretary of State's receiving?
Well, let me ask you a question, because I was away, as you know, and I wasn't quite sure of what was happening. But Kerry stayed out in the beginning, but when they got close, he got into it. Is that right, basically?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One could suspect that what happened is he wanted in on a kill, right? I mean, he wanted in when it looked like it was going to look like
He became visible when it looked like something was going to happen, and he was behind the scenes prior to that.
Much like politicians who decide to endorse candidates in close races when they think that they're going to win, and not if they think they're going to lose, because they don't want to be attached to a losing effort. And that's one thing. You could talk about Kerry and his personal needs, but then you can talk about Netanyahu and, you know, the Saudis and Saudis and the rest of them, as in terms of the outcome being what they consider to be tough on them and their needs, you'd never get anything done ever if you weren't afraid to break those eggshells.
Well, this report that you referenced, Joe, also talks about the deep qualms of America's allies now in the Middle East. And according to this former State Department official they quote, Robert Dannon, it says that they genuinely do fear Iran.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Iran is a tough agent in that region. But there's also frustration that the United States is not consulted with them adequately, our allies in the Middle East, that is, and a more generalized doubt that Washington cannot be counted on to safeguard other people's interests, that we're just out for ourselves. And, you know, that does set up a tough situation for Kerry to try to convince people in United Arab Emirates and Saudi
Arabia. That bastion of democracy, yeah. The United Arab Emirates or the Saudi regime,
well,
our best friends.
They are our historic allies in the region, and they have let us do the bidding for them. They let us come in and oust in the first Gulf War, and then went after Saddam, et cetera. And now, you know, when we don't do something that they believe is in their interests, it's very difficult. I think he's got a lot of challenges, Kerry does, and I kind of agree with philosophically that, you know, it's better to negotiate than not to negotiate. I mean,
I'm surprised by how much flack he's getting, and including from us here today, for doing what we should want him to do, which is to talk to the enemy and seem to come up with a deal. This is diplomacy, as he himself said. You know, okay, we don't have an agreement now. We're negotiating. That's how it's supposed to work. And Alan, it's typical that negotiations at all levels are not done by the ambassador or by the president. The SALT treaties and the détente between the U.S. and Russia, that was all negotiated by underlings until it got really serious, and then you bring in the heavy hitters, you know, Reagan at that time. And so I don't see anything needy about him doing that or grandstanding about that. I think he's actually this and the attempt to get the Palestinians and the Israelis to talk are notable efforts of our Secretary of State. I'm not sure why I'm the one who's usually bashing the administration. Here I am defending it this time.
Yeah. Well, you may be right. I have watched Kerry and his career, and I'm not a big fan. We tried to get Kerry onto these microphones a lot when he was a senator, and we were abysmal failures until he was running for office. you know, and then he came on. So that's why, you know, I have a different perspective, perhaps, Rosemary, than you do. He is not...
just about 10 seconds.
What'd you say?
We just have about 10 seconds.
Okay, I'm done.
Oh, okay. Well, we can continue. We have another half hour. We can talk about it. We're going to go to the news break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome your input as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue along with Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and Alan Chartok. And we welcome your comments as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. A reminder, you can always comment on our webpage or our Facebook page or tweet us at WAMC Roundtable, at WAMC Roundtable. Mike Spain, let's talk about some stories making news in the Times Union, beginning with Global Foundries going to work for Apple.
Using a recipe to make Apple chips, the story says. Well, this is by Larry Rulison, who follows technology very closely for us. And he is reporting today that Global Foundries is preparing to make chips for Apple's iPhone and iPad at the Fab 8 complex in Malta.
As soon as I heard that, I think about the Beatles.
The Beatles.
Fab 4.
Well, this is Fab 8.
Right.
So it's twice as many people as the Beatles. Anyways, he's quoting, unidentified sources for this story. Yeah. But Samsung currently makes microprocessors for Apple at its plant in Austin, Texas. And under this, this situation that's going to unfold in Malta, they'll come and set it all up in Malta so that they can manufacture these coveted Class A series chips that Apple needs.
It's you say they'll come. Who's the they?
I'm sorry. Samsung will come and set it up. Yeah. It's unclear whether they'll sort of be the entity that manufactures them or if Global Foundries is going to work directly with Apple. It's interesting because they are competing companies.
Yeah, Apple. I found that fascinating. That you have Samsung and you have Apple as sort of the two biggies when it comes to cellular technology, and yet They're making the processors for Apple.
They're still in a major patent lawsuit where Apple was the winner and ordered to be – well, they ordered Samsung to pay Apple $1 billion. Then a judge threw that out. They paid about half that, and they're dickering over the rest of it.
Chump change.
Right. Well, it's still a little money. And, Apple is trying to reduce its dependency on Samsung and come up with other places in the U.S. where they can make chips that they need for their next round of iPhones, the iPhone 6. You know, this is what they're thinking about.
Oh, God.
We could talk about what that has in it, but that would be digressing.
But, curved glass, I hear.
Yeah, that's the word, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah,
easier glass. To break.
Oh, no, not easy to break. Some of the toughest stuff going. Anyway, but there's speculation because everybody is really tight-lipped about this. Of course, Global Foundries isn't saying a word. They say you might not ever know what is being made up here. Reportedly, IBM is contracting with them.
I think the NSA needs to come up to Albany, figure this out. I'm so sick of the lack of transparency on this whole thing.
Well, we may not know exactly what's going on there, but we do know that it's probably good for the local economy.
Probably good, but there's nothing in that story about number of jobs. Number of money.
Oh, no, there's been
we don't know.
1,200 jobs that were promised, and it's being fulfilled at this Fab 8. And now they want Fab 8.2, which is a $15 billion plant that's on the drawing boards that is moving through. And if that were to happen, that would be probably just as many or more jobs.
Would that be Fab 16?
No, it'd be Fab 8.2. I don't know how they decide what they name their fabs.
We gave a lot to get them here. We sucked the life out of Austin, which is a wonderful little town, as we all know.
And it's going back to being a little town.
Yeah. So the question then becomes, after we're all done, as in the Puerto Rican experience with Operation Bootstrap, we get a tax exemption, and then the tax exemptions run out and the rest, what happens? Do they go away?
Well, the hope is that they would have, have their foothold in the region. They would have the available workforce that's trained.
Didn't stop them in Austin.
It would disappear in a minute if the money and the continued state support disappeared. We would lose it probably to Europe. which is also coming in. Belgium is making big, big strides.
Sure. Global Foundries has two plants outside of Dresden. And, you know, where they build their next plant could be there, could be here, could be South America.
Can I ask a very naive question? And I'm sorry for being stupid, but what's a foundry again?
Well, that's what they call. Global Foundries calls their microchip manufacturing process.
So foundry.
It's a throwback to like making iron. And
yeah. That's right. Yeah. Right. Right.
Old-fashioned.
Like casting the.
Yeah,
casting.
I wanted to.
Here they etch out. They etch out these giant wafers and where hundreds and hundreds of little microchips are created. Then they send them off to China so they could put them in the iPhones
wafers?
That we buy. Giant silicon wafers.
That you said that because you know you also mentioned that Belgium mm-hmm. was a place that might.
They're not chocolate.
No, Belgian waffles.
Wafers. Yeah. Where you were going there?
Welcome right. back.
See, I thought you were going to make a comparison to wafers and the wafers in the church, and it's sort of a religious faith we have to have that this is so good for our area and our state that we're bringing in this business.
Well,
and I suspect
it is good.
Doesn't a lot of it depend on what our appetite continues to be for this stuff, for this technology? I mean, we're all – they're racing to get –
You think we're going the other way?
Well, yeah. I don't know. Right now, we have to have an iPhone, we have to have an iPad, we have to have a laptop, we have to have a computer, and at some point, if that all merges and we need less stuff.
There was a story just today, a technology story out on one of the tech sites that said that by 2019, the use of smartphones will be up 60%, 70% over what it is now.
I have no doubt about it.
Yeah, I mean, everybody is relying on these little devices. They'll have...
My own personal use will definitely be up by that much.
Hmm. Yeah. I wake up in the middle of the night and I see Redville tablets.
So, yeah, the market will be there. And then these chips will be part of other items. They can be part of your refrigerator, your coffee maker, your car, you know, they'll make your house smart, you know, and you'll be able to control everything.
Put one in your dog and house train it.
We've been talking about this in healthcare and healthcare is a big area where
you can monitor, you could be monitored by your, by the healthcare entity and you might get a beep on your phone saying.
Healthcare will never do it. Okay, let's just,
your blood pressure is up a little bit.
No. They can't even follow their own computers. You go into a doctor, you fill out a piece of paper. In fact, they won't let you come in if you don't fill out the piece of paper with your history. And then you sit there and the nurse asks you the exact same questions that are on the piece of paper. And if you come back in another week, they're going to ask you the same questions.
It should all be
in a computer. What
you've never carried a 24-hour urine jug with you?
I've never done that.
Well, they do that, you know. And now that'll all be remotely controlled, especially if you have money.
Well, the healthcare industry is certainly moving towards, secure ways to let people monitor and manage their body processes so that they be warned about, illnesses that are coming on. And some great progress has been made. I think that is the next big
deep brain surgery, for example, for Parkinson's,
mm-hmm.
where they put mm-hmm. chips in and manage that. That all could be observed from one place. I happen to watch Emergency, my favorite show. Emergency on the old movie channel.
Randolph Mantooth. Greatest actor name ever.
Which one is he?
The dark-haired guy.
Yeah, the dark-haired guy.
Yeah.
This is definitely a tangent.
He's talking about Emergency.
Yeah, because it all started there. The guy would call up. They would go there. Somebody would be fainting. They would get his respiration, and they would call it in on this antiquated old phone to – what's the guy? What's the doctor? Who's the doctor? Famous doctor. Famous actor. Anyway, they'd call him in, and he would say – do this and do that. Now it's all, it's all automatic.
Well, I mean, today if you go into the, to have an X-ray, if you, break your collarbone or a kid breaks or fractures his arm or something, if it's late in the day, it could be that radiologist could be, in New Guinea.
In Colorado.
Colorado or Australia or something like that, It is affecting healthcare already, even though there are antiquated local doctor's offices that still use pens and paper and carbon paper, et cetera.
Very few.
But it's, it is moving that way. And so I guess the answer is there will be a continue increasing dependency on microchips, and it's good if we if they invest all this money into the region, because it is a lot of money. $15 billion for Fab 8.2 is the projected cost. If that is built, you don't want to just like abandon that. And it's not like a Walmart where they'll move down the street to a bigger site and leave the empty Walmart. You know, that's pretty big change, and maybe they'll, you know, and that will have built an infrastructure to support it, and that's the
hope. Is this good for the Times Union in terms of advertising?
I don't think Global Foundries advertises a lot in the Times Union, but what is good for the Times Union, and I think is good for this region, is if there's people with good jobs doing well, and, you know, it feeds on itself, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation and get to other stories as well from the Times Union and beyond. We welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Handmade & More in New Paltz, offering a mix of American handcrafted and internationally made crafts and jewelry, plus toys, paper goods, and women's clothing accessories on Facebook. And in New Leaf Used Books, Pine Plains, New York, an independent bookstore with 7 rooms of books, fiction, poetry, history, gardening, cookbooks, and more, open daily 12 noon to 5 p.m., a New Leaf Used Books on Facebook.
Welcome back to the roundtable. During the break, we were having a little discussion about governors, and you have an interesting story. Casey Seiler has a story in the Times Union about Carl Paladino, ready to rematch Governor Cuomo, not as a Republican though.
No, Casey's story today, focuses on. Who is going to step forward to challenge Governor Cuomo when he is expected to seek a second term next year? And one of the familiar names is Carl Paladino, who has, after losing by a more than 2-1 margin in the previous contest with Andrew Cuomo, has managed to get elected to the Board of Education in Buffalo, where he is pushing his conservative ideas, and he was on Fox News being interviewed, and he basically said, "I would very seriously consider waging another challenge to Governor Cuomo, but not as a Republican." Casey called around, and he talked to the Conservative Party chairman, Mike Long, and he did acknowledge that he had discussed next year's gubernatorial race with Carl Paladino. And he says there is a lot of opposition to the SAFE Act, and a lot of people are angry at Cuomo, and it might be a good year for a conservative candidate to make grounds. But then you start to think about the year in 1990 when Herb London ran as a conservative, and the Republicans picked Pierre Rinfre to go against Mario Cuomo, and that split the vote even more and made it easier for Mario Cuomo to be reelected. And so if the Republican Party and the Conservative Party can't get their act together and back one candidate, it's going to be an uphill battle anyway to unseat a popular Democratic governor in New York State, a very blue state. But if they split, I just don't know how they could even make a formidable challenge to Cuomo.
Well, I think the issue is if they haven't got anybody, then anything can happen.
If you have money, you can run.
So, and that's, by the way, what the Republicans have been doing for years. It was the secret of Pierre and Frey. You know, you get somebody who can basically be self-funding because they're not going to get the money if the perception is you're not going to win. So then you need somebody who has deep pockets and can do that. You know, I think the issue for them is really quite difficult. The conservatives, of course, Carl Paladino, the fickle finger of fate has touched him. It's like somebody, you know, who has experienced something. I don't want to say it on the radio for the first time. And then they haven't got enough.
It's adrenaline you get,
same,
I guess.
Same thing is true here.
Yeah.
I think the guy, you know, he's, you know, you're not going to live forever. You got all this money. Why not? Why not run on a conservative?
He was not an impressive candidate.
He's terrible.
Has done nothing or not very much since, whereas our governor has continued to be popular, makes actions that have kept him in the forefront of the news nationally. And that's really the best the Republican Party can do is Carl Paladino. Again.
No, it's not the Republican Party. This would be the conservative party.
Right.
Either one.
He doesn't want to run as a Republican.
Well, the conservative party is, you see, the thing about the conservative party here is that they can get enough votes with one guy who's a, quote, true conservative so that they maintain the third position on the ballot.
So that's good for the party. I do understand that. But really, that is that the best for the state of New York?
Well, what do you think that's what they're thinking about, what's best for the state of New York?
Wow.
Well, I mean, so they're trying to leverage – I mean, the conservative party uses – an example like Carl Paladino, talking about running to kind of push the Republican Party to find someone who's acceptable to conservatives. And now you got to find someone who's acceptable to conservatives, who has broader appeal across the state, who can tap into the angst about the gun law and taxes and whatever else you want to throw at Cuomo. You can maybe blame him for the Common Core curriculum or something, you know. And if you got a populist, maybe there would be a fight. But, boy, I can't think of anybody, and it certainly isn't Carl Paladino.
Chris Christie knows about this problem, doesn't
he? Right, right. Well, Carl Paladino actually doesn't like Chris Christie either. He mentioned that during his interview.
Such a strange character.
During his interview.
I know this is going to be labeled as a tangent. But I'm telling you now, the presidential election is going to be between Chris Christie and Hillary Clinton, and it is going to be a very close election. People like Christie. It's that simple. So you saw all kinds of people who philosophically probably don't have much in common with him who are voting for him. We were talking about women and Hispanics and voting for him. So I think, and dare I say this, that Chris Christie has that sort of personal magnetism. That maybe Hillary Clinton, who is an amazing individual, doesn't have. And so I think it's going to be a very close election. The real question is, will the Republicans cut their own throats and
try to pull him right?
Well, not try to pull him right,
he's kind of
but nominate somebody who is right as opposed to Christie.
All right. just checking. Final story, and this was by request, and it's a darn good one. So let's get to it. Rosemary requested this.
We actually have already begun talking about it.
We actually did begin talking about this, some during the break and some actually on the air. And that is about technology has given us the means to work all the time, but should we? This is an article in the Times Union that was yesterday by Lee Hornbeck. And it's a fascinating article about how we have access to our work at home, but also we have access to our home at work. Right. And it is it's an interesting.
Well, it's why you get an email from Joe Donahue at 8 or 9 o'clock at night saying, here's some topics to talk about tomorrow morning.
Or Alan Chartok at 3 a.m.
At 3 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Or students at any time of the day and night, you know. Professor. Well,
the guy that I really loved the most in my early teaching career was Sebastian de Grazia, famous political scientist, long gone, wrote a book for the 20th Century Fund called Of Time, Work, and Leisure. And basically, he predicted all of this. He said, "Look, we're going to have so much is going to be done by automation and these things that there aren't going to be enough jobs to go around."
Yeah,
and that's fascinating.
It's a good in the sense that businesses like the one you were just talking about will prosper. I think that we will be using more devices and they will continue to get very sophisticated. On the other hand, we lost that wonderful psychological piece that came from leaving work. I'm going home now.
Right.
And you would go home and sit down and change your clothes.
Take a bubble bath.
Take a bubble bath. Oh, yeah. Did anybody
do that anymore? Smartphone into the bubble bath.
Yeah. Yeah. And we never have that. We're on all the time. The story that you're talking about, it's in the Times Union, talks about how many people use their phones, consult their phones at the dinner table. First thing in the morning they do is grab their cell phone.
Yeah, read some of those.
A
lot of New Yorker cartoons have come out of this.
50% check their work email while still in bed. 68% of people check their work emails before 8 a.m. 57% check work emails on family outings. 38% routinely check work work email as well. At the dinner table, 40% still do work email after 10 p.m. 69% will not go to sleep without checking their work email. I mean, I'm guilty of every one of those.
Yeah. How many here are not guilty of every one of those?
We have there's an interesting experiment that you do with young journalism students. They're doing it at UAlbany where they are required to shut off all devices for 48 hours. They're allowed to use their cell phones to make a phone call, but they cannot use it to get data or to check Google.
Or to cheat on a threat test.
They have to write about the experience, and it's shocking. It's like addiction. It's the same language of addicts who are cut off from their cell phones.
A colleague of mine at work, her daughter,
went off for one of these church groups that went down to West Virginia at Easter break to, help rebuild some houses or something, some kind of a public service group was nice. And they made them, turn off their phones the whole time. And it just a very interesting experience, she said.
You
have been very worried about that now, Rose.
I know. He still does it. He just labels it now.
There's this great article in Times. We've talked about it, in which the concept of planned obsolescence in cell phones, iPhones.
Suddenly my
iPhone cannot be turned off. I want to mention that. So when you go on, it cannot be turned off. So when you go on the and believe me, I've consulted with a lot of experts on that, including the people here. And then it turns out a lot of people cannot ever turn off their iPhones. You press the button, and then you're supposed to pull the red thing off.
Hold that little top button and the bottom button at the same time, it doesn't go off.
No, you cannot do it. I mean, I'm telling you now, it's been awful. What I'm really worried about is that on the airplane, they say, please turn off your phones the way off.
They're doing away with that.
While you're out of the country, we fixed all that.
But what I'm worried about that is that, somebody will come up to me and say, we have electronic means for figuring this out, and your iPhone is on no matter what. You're under arrest.
We'll bail you.
Like Alec Baldwin for playing the game.
Right.
What did they say when we were talking about this last week? When they lifted it all, they said that 60 or 70% of the people were doing it anyway. Nobody was actually turning it on.
I would kind of put it on airplane mode and then sleep mode and put it in my pocket so I could pull it out. I don't do anything.
I just put it in a pocket. It's just like, listen to us on the safety talk. Who listens to that? Who turns off their phone?
Well, I'd like to know how to use that water flotation device. should we go down?
Or the oxygen thing. Do not put this on your children first. That always seemed like good advice to me.
Take care of yourself first, Rosemary.
But people are relying on them, whether they can turn them on or off. They are relying on them pretty much 24/7.
Anyway, this article has inspired in me a new campaign. I'm going to reduce stress by shutting off my phones and my other devices more.
People find that stressful, though. They want to know what's going on.
Well, there's also the issue about the reason that a lot of people do it is because then, what are you walking into in the morning?
As I always say to Roselle, what if the queen called?
Well, I like Joe's way of putting it. But being on top of things so that you're prepared when it's required that you be prepared, I think that's what people are doing. They just want to stay in touch so there's no surprises.
It's a control thing.
That sounds like a justification, a rationalization.
What? Well, I'm sure it is.
What? It is. We were talking about...
I can stop anytime I want.
I didn't say that.
Guys who drink Diet Pepsi.
Yeah. I didn't say that.
I could quit my iPhone if I needed to.
But the queen might call. that makes sense.
All right. Time to wrap up. Thank you very much for being with us. As always, we'd love to hear from you. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back tomorrow for another insightful gathering. Mike, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And we'll see you next week as well. And the roundtable will continue right here on WAMC.